guys, welcome to another episode of the SOS Show. I'm your host Suchita, and today I'm also being joined by my co-host Rohan Tucker. We're going to have some fantastic conversation on mental health, as we have a very special guest today. We have the director of Mariwala Health Initiative, MHI, Rajri Mariwala, joining us. MHI was founded in the year 2015 by Mr. Harsh Mariwala, who does not need any introduction. MHI provides grants and strategic support to organizations and collectives working within communities to provide greater access to mental health services for all. You can check them out at mhi.org.in. We will talk about various things, but first we'll start the conversation with Rajri herself. What drove her towards mental health, her own battle with anxiety. We will also talk about Reframe, the journal which MHI comes out with. Reframe, just to define a bit, is a journal through which MHI endeavors to not only transform the existing discussions around mental health, but also to widen the scope for participation in these crucial conversations. Their first issues highlighted the need for funding rights-based MH work, given that the mental health sector has not been a priority in philanthropy or CSR in India. And their second issue deals with bridging the care gap.
Hi Rajri, welcome to the SOS Show. How are you feeling about being in this mental health show, which is your passion?
Hi Suchita, thanks so much for having me here. As you rightly said, mental health is my passion, so yes, it's very hard for me to keep quiet about it. So excited to be here.
Awesome. How was your trip to New York?
My trip to New York was absolutely excellent. It's a very good sign to see that mental health is being spoken about at a global stage, mm-hmm. at the UN. Mm-hmm. So this is really great in terms of the mental health movement, mm-hmm. that finally mental health is starting to get the importance it deserves.
Mm-hmm. How was it moderating a panel?
So I was extremely nervous and anxious to be moderating a panel with not one, but two ministers, from one from the Dutch government and one from the Norwegian government. Mm-hmm. And as well as the president of the International Red Cross Committee.
Oh my God.
So
wow.
It was daunting, mm-hmm. but again, because one is passionate about mental health, mm. It was very easy for me to say, now this is my chance to hold you accountable. What are you going to do for mental health?
Awesome. How was the response? How was the energy there? With respect to mental health,
the energy was fabulous. The UN health secretary, Dr. Tedros, the WHO secretary, is a big proponent of mental health. We had quite a few prominent figures talking about mental health. The other person to take the stage as part of this campaign, this is part of a larger campaign called Speak Your Mind, mm-hmm. was Robin Williams' son, Zach Williams.
Of course.
And he spoke about his personal connection with mental health and what he's doing in the field.
Awesome. Before I get slightly personal with you, I wish to know from your perspective, since you're doing so much work, MHI is doing so much work in the mental health space, literally driving a lot of and steering a lot of things in the mental health space. Where do you see the mental health ecosystem heading?
So I think in India, if I'm to talk about it, I think innovative work around mental health has always happened. Mm-hmm. It's not received the attention that it should have. Mm-hmm. It's not received the funding it should have.
Yes.
And I think that's changing slowly, hopefully.
Yes.
There are many, many activists who have worked untiringly.
Yes.
For a long time on mental health. And if we manage to use some of the tools we have at hand, I think in the future, it's going to be a much better scenario for mental health. Mm-hmm. But we have to use the tools. Mm-hmm. We cannot just stand on what has been done so far.
Absolutely.
So, for example, the Mental Health Care Act,
yes,
which is in legislation, it's one of the most progressive mental health care acts in the world.
Yes.
Unless as activists and as a community and all the stakeholders push, if this act is not implemented, it's going to be essentially useless.
Absolutely.
So we need to keep on pushing the envelope in mental health if we want to see change. And let's face it, it's a very grave problem for this country.
Absolutely. The Mental Health Care Act, we had this huge and long discussion while we were in Pune, and I'm going to come to that. But before that, getting slightly personal with you, what drove you towards the mental health ecosystem?
So I've always been passionate about mental health. Mm. Even as when I was much younger, I wanted to study some amount of psychology. So I did take some classes at an undergraduate level. Mm-hmm. After I'd finished studying, I took a few diploma courses on arts-based therapy and other different facets of mental health. Mm-hmm. So that's one, entrance point into mental health. I was interested maybe from the academic or the understanding of it. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that as a feminist, I do think mental health is a very feminist issue. Mm-hmm. Simply because it's related to many other things. It's related, if I have mental health, then I'm able to access employment, housing, social relationships. Mm-hmm. So I do see it as an intersectoral issue and as an intersectional issue. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm homeless, if I'm poor, then my mental health impacts are likely to be more serious. Mm-hmm. So the second point is as a feminist. And then the third point is as someone who lives with mental health issues themselves. So I take daily medication for an anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky because I have the privileges to reach out, get the right type of help, get mental health professionals who I can trust and who guide me. But not everyone has that. And so these are the three things that really pushed me.
Mm, absolutely. Anxiety disorders. Would you like to elaborate a bit? What do you go through?
Actually, for the longest time, I thought it was completely normal for anyone to wake up with anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I wake up with anxiety my whole life. It was much later that I realized that it's actually not normal to wake up with anxiety. And so I have an anxiety disorder in which I have anxiety at any given time. There's no real trigger for it. Mm-hmm. So it was so part of my life that it took me a very long time to realize that it may not be so for everyone else.
Absolutely. So is it like a do you do any medication plus some kind of other care or therapy?
Yes. So as I said, I take daily medication. But other than the medication, I also have a therapist, so like a talk therapist. And the third thing is really looking at myself and saying, what can I change in my life that gives me less anxiety? And that's partly why, I do what I do. So I'm a dog trainer and a feline behaviorist. And I realize that when I'm in a session with a dog, I have zero anxiety. Because that's the only point in time at which I can focus on something and have my brain there completely. Otherwise, I always have multiple pathways to anxiety, multiple thoughts in my brain. But it's when I'm with dogs that I'm completely, at peace.
Yes.
So in that sense, this sort of a lifestyle change, I think, is really helpful. Not to mention that it was always my dream. So I killed two birds with one stone. Absolutely. Not that I'm condoning any animal cruelty. I would never kill two birds, but,
Okay, I'm going to just go a bit detailed before we come to Mr. Rohan Thakkar, who is also our co-host today. Before Rohan takes over, I'm going to just go slightly more, a bit, if you're comfortable.
Sure.
In terms of an anxiety disorder, I also, didn't we sort of, we were talking about it yesterday. You were telling me that our Bollywood actor, Shraddha Kapoor, has anxiety disorders.
Yes, I did read an article about it.
Rajvi, have you ever thought or delved deeper into where does this come from?
You know, as far as I can tell, I have had it since I was a child. Some of my earliest memories, now that I think back and that I can analyze, are related to anxiety. So anxiety,
I think it'll be a very common problem which a lot of people won't even be aware about.
Exactly. And, unfortunately, in our school systems also, they're not equipped to understand it.
Yes.
So, for example, I think in the second or third standard, I was actually made to sit on a desk outside the classroom. I think because my anxiety levels were so high that I would constantly throw up. So they gave me a bucket and put my desk outside the classroom, just outside, so the teacher could see me. And so I could throw up and write the exam.
Oh, my God.
So, it would be great if our school systems can pick this up.
Absolutely.
And of course, at that time, no one really connected it to anxiety.
Yes.
And so I just went through it, throwing up and writing my exams.
Oh, my God. But I don't think anxiety is a term that even considered something that would need a medication.
Exactly.
Or a therapy.
Exactly. And I think some anxieties don't. I mean, I think if you have anxiety related to maybe giving a speech.
Yes, I have. I have that. Yeah. Yeah.
Surprising.
Stage phobia, not the speech phobia. The stage phobia, like going on the stage and...
So certain amounts of anxiety can improve your performance.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And that's natural. But when it becomes unmanageable and when it, manifests in these physiological symptoms, I would say that one really needs to look at how to deal with it.
Absolutely. From having an anxiety in school, throwing up to you're curating, a talk at United Nations. Wow. I mean, that's like a huge, huge curve. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yes, luckily I did not feel like throwing up. I'm happy to report.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to just stretch a bit more before Rohan takes over. We had this conversation, which is for our October 10th World Mental Health Day, and we were in Pune.
Sure.
And we had Mr. Amrit Bakshi, who's an activist and a caregiver. We had Arjun, the lawyer, and we had Uma Dalvi, the psychologist, the clinical psychologist. And the things that we spoke about was Mental Health Care Act. And what came out of it was 3 to 4 very big loopholes that we should work upon when it comes to mental health ecosystem. Or we are never going to move forward, we are going to be stuck there. And while I was going through the reframe, the journal of MHI, I realized that all those things are mentioned in such a comprehensive and in a concise way. You can understand it so clearly, One was related to the cost factor. And, high cost when it comes to mental health system, something that can become daunting for a middle-class family and, of course, the underprivileged. And sometimes the high cost, when you are not able to access a public healthcare system, you go to a private healthcare system. So that was the one point. Would you like to comment on it?
So as you rightly said, the costs are daunting for a large part of our population.
Yeah.
Now, thanks to the Mental Health Care Act, there are certain psychiatric medications that should be provided free of cost. But...
Yeah.
As you said, there are loopholes. We don't know how much it's being implemented.
Yes.
And unfortunately, we don't know the degree also that it's being implemented to. So we don't even have the research to say it's happening in X pocket, it's happening in X state.
Absolutely.
Before we can actually go ahead and press the government for accountability, we need the research on what is exactly happening where. Ideally, I would like some report card for each district and for someone to do that research.
Mm. Absolutely. And also the second point, Rajvi, came out from our discussion was the lack of infrastructure. So if somebody wants to access, suppose there is a severe mental health case, for example, of a hallucinatory schizophrenia, and somebody, a family wants help in the middle of the night. At 2 o'clock in the night, I know of an example that's happened and the help was never there, The private hospitals apparently go slightly more on the higher side. What would you suggest in such event, in such cases?
So again, there's such a lack of resources.
Yes.
That until and unless the government provides.
Yes.
I can't even in all honesty and good faith say go to a public hospital because we don't know whether the psychiatrist who's supposed to be sitting there is sitting there. There are very few options.
Yeah.
And then again, we have to look at and lean on the informal networks, the peer networks, the caregiver support networks for help. The only other thing that I say that could be of use possibly is that the Mental Health Care Act has mandated that ambulances should ferry persons with mental health issues and give them the same rights as persons with physical health issues.
Yes.
So we do know that that's happening in Maharashtra.
Mm-hmm.
If you call 108, that people are using ambulances for mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
But until our infrastructure copes, unfortunately, the whole burden of the system is coming on caregiver networks, peer support networks, and activists.
Absolutely. And the third point we came across was in terms of the research. Now, coming example to Amritsar's daughter, she has chronic schizophrenia, and I know of several cases of where there is chronic schizophrenia. Unfortunately, the medicines that are being subscribed and pumped into the system of the patient, it's not working in 100%, scale. And despite her proper medication for 20 years,
right.
She's not been able to come back to functioning. Do you feel there is a lack of research, and how do we take care of that?
So, looking at mental health or mental illness only through a biomedical lens is something that I have an issue with.
Yes.
And as MHI also, we take a stand on it.
Yes.
In fact, what we advocate is called demedicalization,
mm-hmm.
which means looking at mental health at not just a biological level, but a cognitive, emotional, behavioral, and social level.
Absolutely.
So, just rather on looking at certain symptoms and then giving medication only to reduce those symptoms.
Yes.
Or let's say...
suppress it.
Suppress those systems, symptoms.
Yeah.
One has to take a slightly wider view. It cannot just be symptom reduction.
Mm.
And as you rightly said, that it may not actually... be changing the situation for that person. It
yes.
could be just like slapping a band-aid on.
Absolutely.
So the idea then is to actually change the lens of mental health itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we try to do with both issues of Reframe, both Reframe 1 and Reframe 2.
Absolutely. So the next step in terms of the implementation of the Mental Health Care Act 2017, which has not been done till now, we're entering 2020. Any suggestions in terms of how do we push the government to take a stand?
So I'll tell you, earlier this year, MHI and Center for Mental Health Law and Practice, Anjali Mental Health in Calcutta,
yes.
and a few others decided to use the elections to raise awareness on the Mental Health Care Act
yeah.
and to try and get political parties to say that mental health is important.
Yes.
So for the very first time in Indian history,
mm-hmm.
Two political parties mentioned promises on mental health
mm-hmm.
in their manifestos.
Mm-hmm.
That was just step one.
Mm.
How do we get governments, which is at the center and at the state,
yes.
to implement it? Unfortunately, it is going to have to come from the mental health ecosystem. And I do think that private players, private practitioners, hospitals, and obviously the activists as well as civil society must play their part in pushing their state governments or the central government to start implementing the Mental Health Care Act. Unless there is a push from us, I don't see it happening.
Yes.
Unless there's a push so that our governments know that mental health matters to our votes, matters to their electorate, I don't see it happening.
Absolutely. Rohan Thakur?
So just coming to this point about pushing the government. So recently, not just talking about the mental health scenario, but talking about everything that is happening in the environment right now. So the people, residents of Mumbai are pushing about the Aare forest.
Okay.
So it's just an example, but judiciary have given a clean chit on cutting down of this area.
Sure.
So in spite of the public taking a stand, protesting so much, nothing concrete is being done. So do you think just protesting or taking some action is enough?
So as a person and as a feminist, yes. I am all for protest. I do go to quite a few protests, let
yes.
me tell you. But there are many other ways to do it. The Bridge the Care Gap campaign was
yes.
one of those.
Mm.
Like I mentioned earlier, there is a global campaign called Speak Your Mind,
mm.
Which is run by 15 countries. And the idea is not just to put a spotlight on mental health at the global stage,
mm.
but also to do things within our own countries. So Kenya has a plan for itself and Speak Your Mind mm. in their country. Nigeria has a plan in their country. Now for India, what we plan to do is we plan to work with youth mental health advocates, train them with an advocacy toolkit, and ask them to go and advocate at multiple levels of government. So it cannot just be through protests. We also have to plan it a little bit more. This is one of the ways in which we plan to do it. Some of the other things could be actively approaching people in different bureaucracies. One of the other programs that MHI supports is actually providing governments the technical support to implement the Mental Health Care Act. Right. Let's not forget that the government may not have the competencies in their bureaucracies to do it. So how do we help that and facilitate that?
Correct.
One way to do it is to provide technical support. The other way to do it is to, say, for example, provide services that work in conjunction with or in partnership with government services. MHI supports a program called Atmiyata, which runs in 500 villages in the Mehsana district. People are able to get a certain basic level of counseling within their own village. And if they need more, their visit to the district level psychiatrist is facilitated by the program. So the government then does keep the psychiatrist there because it's working perfectly for them. They have enough walk-ins. Otherwise, if you think about it, a psychiatrist sitting in a district hospital in Mehsana may not have that many walk-ins because villagers may not know where to go. It may be too daunting to walk into a hospital and ask these questions if they know even to go into a hospital. So it has to work in both ways. And I do believe that while we should protest and while we should raise our voice against injustice, there are many multiple things that we should do and work creatively with the government to keep the government accountable.
It's very right that to do something, not just private people, but private institutes, individuals, not just private, but also the government should come forward. Like I was telling before, that activists will do that job, but it's the job of the government to do that job. Activists should only push the government to take action.
Absolutely. Activists should push the government. And then if private players step in and say, I'm going to build this hospital, I'm going to put in these resources, that takes some of the load off the government. So, you know, ideally, we want the government to do it. Because if we want no one to be left behind, it is only the government who can do it.
So reaching at the most cornermost point.
Absolutely. Leave no one behind.
Right. I just have a pointer with reference to Atmita, as I was also reading Reframe. And of course, we had this conversation with Kaustub Juwag on Atmita. And it was such a brilliant conversation. And I sort of asked him constantly, I've always felt that there's a lack of, you know, the Atmita model in the urban spaces, you know. And I think it's something that, how are you guys taking that point?
So while we don't have the Atmita model in urban spaces, there are quite a few urban mental health models that are in force right now. A couple of them from our partners, for example. I will speak only from my partners because those are the programs I know best. But for example, Pune has a program called Seher run by Bapu Trust. So that works in urban, traditional urban basties.
Does that work in, suppose, in a city's landscape, for example, like in a Bangalore or in a Mumbai kind of a space?
So Pune is one example, but the other example we have is in Mumbai. Our partner Anubhuti Trust works in Kalyan and Dombivli at a very similar level. So again, persons get counseling and mental health support from where they live. But if further help is needed, then those resources are made available. Similarly, with our partner Sneha, who work in Dharavi. So they run a program called Hesas, and that works in particular with young people. But again, it is working in this urban area.
Absolutely. And also, you know, if you need somebody in Warsowa and Andheri West as well, we would, you know, there are cases around me and all the time I keep meeting them in boardrooms.
But, you know, I have to say that if I look beyond just geography, now the iCall helpline actually fields calls from all over India.
It's brilliant,
And they field calls not just from Bombay and Delhi and Bangalore, but often enough, they get calls from villages so small that the person who's calling doesn't know which district their village is in. So they are able to take a wider range of calls. I think, you know, that's one of the good example of using tech in mental health.
Absolutely.
So coming to the part that we were discussing, Reframe.
So sure.
What is MHI doing with Reframe? What is it exactly?
We started MHI in 2015. And in 2018, I realized that we hadn't published an annual report.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, should we publish an annual report? Then I thought a little more and said, but annual reports are very boring. Who reads them? Is it just going to be a waste of paper? I really don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was that because for MHI, it's very important to generate more discussion in mental health.
Yes.
To question the ideas of mental health being solely a pharmacological pursuit. Let's look at changing the conversations around mental health. This was one of our aims at the very beginning. So that's when I said, instead of doing an annual report, let's do a journal.
Yeah.
We can, of course, at the end of every journal, have a bit on MHI and what we've done in the last year. But let's use this journal as a platform to really change the way we talk about mental health. Let's get more voices in there. I don't want only psychiatric voices speaking as it is in a lot of mainstream media. So let's see what we can do to shake it up. And that's how Reframe was born.
That's wonderful. I was just reading both the versions of the last year and this year's. And you have mentioned everything in so much of detail that any layman who doesn't know what mental health is, what mental illness is, what is the situation of mental health in the country, I think just reading that journal will give him the perfect idea. And what should one do in that? Talking about this year's theme, which you had kept, is Bridge the Gap.
Yes.
So bringing more awareness to the community about mental health and including the people who are suffering from it, mild to severe, including them in the community. So what can you say more about Bridge the Gap?
So as I think Suchita pointed this out earlier in the show. There are gaps. There's lots of loopholes.
Yeah.
How do we bridge those? And at a more basic level, when we talk about mental health, we're always talking about cure. I want to know where the care is in the cure.
Yes.
So that's why it's Bridge the Care Gap. So,
yes.
So
that's what the focus
that.
Is.
Yeah. That's a beautiful point. The care aspect is where we need to focus as much on the medical aspect.
Absolutely. And if I use your example of the story of 2 a.m. and not finding help, you're not looking for a cure at 2 a.m. You're looking for care. And those are the places where the biggest gaps are.
Yes.
So how do we fix those? Mm-hmm. How do we even start looking at those?
Yes.
Yeah.
And have we looked at those before?
Mm-hmm.
The other point about cure is that, you know, a lot of mental health studies, academia, all of that is from the West. How are we adapting it to our concepts? How are we adapting it to our environments?
Yes.
So that's the other point I wanted to take a look at. Otherwise, we are just taking everything from the West and maybe copy-pasting it is not the best idea.
Yes, what works there may not work here because of the diversities.
Or what works here may not work there. I don't know how an Atmiyata program will work in the USA. Our society is rather different.
So this conversation, as we, to all the listeners, as we are proceeding in this conversation, there would be some snippets from the contributors of the Reframe. So we would be plugging them in between. And to begin with the snippet, we would like to share some points from Meera Malhotra, who has designed the Reframe, on what she has to say about designing and putting out content to make mental health awareness simpler.
So actually, this is a very good point. In terms of actually doing Reframe, it takes us a good 3-4 months of meetings where some of us will write. The first Reframe, it was me and Amelina Dave, who's part of our advisory board, who sat down to write it. And then we would sit in meetings with Meera, and Meera would say, look, I don't understand this bit at all. Let's use a diagram to flesh it out. I need this from you so that this diagram works. So it's really the content is not just the written word.
Yes.
It's also in the illustrations, because that's part of the problem with mental health, that the language around it is so hard to understand. And it can't just be that if you're a professional or if you're living with mental health, lots of time if you're living with mental illness also, it's very hard to understand.
Yes.
So while I say that it's still a work in progress on both Reframes, it can be hard to read. It's very important that we make mental health easy for people to understand, accessible to read, which is why there's a lot of focus on the actual design of it.
For me, really, Reframe was more like a journey. And I think that's why it resulted in a journal. It wasn't something that came out of a brief and then we just responded to it just by, you know, designing what we got in hand. I call that vending machine design. And in the social good space, the social sector, you have to put a little more work into it. You can't be distant from the content when you are designing for social good. It's very important that you understand it, because it can so easily be misunderstood, or it can so easily be a lost opportunity, or several other things can happen which are sometimes even disastrous. So involving ourselves with the content was one of the biggest reasons why it evolved the way it did. And it is in great part because our client was also willing to sit down with us and talk to us. And it's then when we also realized that, you know, I'm learning so much inside this conference room. And why don't people, a general wider audience, know about things about mental health that we are learning in this conference room? So it was about taking those things out and telling people more about, because it's still a very new, even in the social good sector, it's a very new concept to many people, and people don't understand it as easily as they understand, say, childcare or sanitation or something like that. So being able to do that was itself like an amazing experience, to talk to your client openly and, you know, literally have like 4-hour long sessions on how this page should look, because how do you want it to be understood? One of the biggest things that I see is there's a gap between, you know, what is academic and understood by people at a higher level who are talking about research or advocacy, law, and then there's the common person who doesn't quite understand all these things. How do we, as a mental health initiative, sort of break it down for them? And that's how we dismantle stigma, right? By demystifying the information.
So you would share those designs in the description as well, and also on our social media handles, so that you listeners can understand it better as we proceed further in reframe.
Sure.
What fascinated me with the design was you specifically dissected the three parts of the care which is there. One is the treatment, then the physical health aspect, and
yes,
the psychosocial aspect, which is the key focus that you are working on right now.
Yes.
So Jasmine Khala has written something well on that. So Jasmine would be saying something on that as well.
I'm sure Jasmine wrote a piece on bridging the care gap, which is intended to then give good perspective to the rest of the material.
Hi, I'm here to speak about the Reframe Journal article by Mariwala Health Initiative. The title of the article is Pathways to Mental Health, where we have spoken to the need for mental health to be a priority action issue by the state, given that it impacts the lives of 150 million Indians who have a mental health problem. We know from research that people who need mental health care services often are not able to access the same. And this gap in India is almost about 70 to 92%. We also know from research that while India accounted for about 17% of the global population in 2016, we did account for about 36% of the global suicide deaths among women and 24% deaths among men. We also know that for women who are younger than 40, suicide has become the leading cause of death, which is even ahead of the maternal mortality rate. So clearly we know that there is, the scale of the issue is rather large and we need to do something about it. The article has borrowed the concept of mental health care gap that has been defined by Patare, Brazinova and Levav, which is then trying to reframe the earlier understood notion of the treatment gap. The treatment gap has been, in a traditional notion, been understood as from a biomedical perspective, and therefore often gets interpreted by policymakers, planners, researchers, non-professional stakeholders to refer to a curative and clinical approach to mental health. While that is a valid argument, the authors have argued that we need to broaden this conversation to not just talk about treatment gap as a clinical issue, but treatment gap, which can address psychosocial interventions that have been proven to be effective and to also address physical healthcare gaps that exist for people with mental health problems. And we need to talk about these psychosocial interventions and physical healthcare gap because it is an important process for people's recovery. The definition of recovery as it's seen in the article is to think about a more person-centric approach which enables people to lead a life as per their will and preference, despite having the illness and the symptoms. We also know from research that mental health is impacted by various psychosocial determinants such as poverty, unemployment, lack of housing, domestic violence. We know that discrimination on the basis of gender, caste, sexuality have shown negative impacts on mental health. Therefore, the mental health care gap then speaks to and encourages us to think about more effective, evidence-based psychosocial interventions that need to be addressed for this mental health care gap, along with a clinical model of treatment and care. We also know from research that people with severe mental illness die 10 to 20 years earlier than the general population. And this is often due to physical diseases that either are not identified early enough, not treated effectively, or not prevented because there is an assumption that mental health care and physical health care needs are somehow different. And therefore, the mental health care gap is then encouraging us to look at people's needs for physical health care, as well as look at the psychosocial interventions, as well as look at the treatment gap to make it this a more holistic and a more comprehensive term of mental health care gap.
So as we move to reframe, another focus is about recovery and rehabilitating. So would you like to say something on that? How is it taking place right now and how should it take place?
So, in terms of recovery, again, I was talking about Western models.
Yes.
Now, the recovery movement started abroad in the West with people who lived with mental illness claiming it as part of their narratives.
Mm.
Now it's reached a stage where, people are shown recovering in some way. Oh, I lived with this thing. Now I'm fine. And now I'm, doing great in my life. But actually, that's not the case. And we may not even be talking like that in India.
Yes. Yeah.
What does it mean in a rural context, for example? What does recovery mean? Do we have recovery at all? That's one of the pieces.
Yes.
The second piece is looking at what recovery means for someone who lives in a village in Uttarakhand. Now, it could mean good health. Why is this important for us in mental health? If we don't know what our final goals are with the people that we work with.
Yes. Absolutely.
It's not going to work. And we cannot just simply copy paste from the West and say, these are our goals.
Yeah.
So when it comes to understanding more about recovery, what is it in the Indian context?
So there's actually not much work at all on recovery in the Indian context. There's not too much research on it at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like taking the example of Richa, Amritsar's daughter. How can you even understand the recovery aspect?
Correct.
After 28 years.
Correct. So one of the articles says that recovery is not a concept for me that works.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm never going to recover. That's what the author writes.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what has been presumed by the society as well. Like I was talking to Anand Chabukswar, the arts-based therapy. I said, what is the recovery percentage of the people who come with a severe mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar, any other aspect? And he said that they are functioning every day. They're understanding what they're doing every day. And some of them sometimes respond to what we are doing in terms of the imagination, your music therapy, your dance therapy, other forms of therapy, drama therapy. But they will not be able to go back to, for example, a job.
The thing that I really liked in the reframe was that it's quite a dialogue kind of sense about it rather than focusing on, the definitive answers. In terms of our actual paper and the focus we were doing, we were looking at recovery and particularly critiquing the idea that recovery is something that can be defined in one way. And the work that we had done together with Sumit Jain and others was developing a contextually relevant recovery tool, which was developed together with, was co-produced with a group of experts by Experience, who are people in Uttarakhand who were both had their own lived experience of psychosocial disability or who have been carers. And so we discussed this paper and this project that we had done and what were some of the challenges for that. But also we were keen to talk about some of the challenges for having genuine participation and the importance of local context. So an interesting example on the local context, we had decided to do some work around promoting income generation. And we had thought that supporting people with psychosocial disability to care for a couple of goats would be a good initiative. And we got some funding and we bought some goats. And there were about five families started off with a couple of goats each. And we suggested that, of course, you know, my grandfather had been a sheep farmer and we knew that you should have your kids should be born in spring at the end of winter. That's everyone seems to know that. But the community were quite disagreeing with this. And they're like, no, the time for kids is if they have their kids in about June or July, then they'll be in prime milk production for monsoon. And our whole team was like, what? Why do you need milk production in monsoon? And they said, well, that's when dengue fever is most common, and everyone knows that dengue fever should be treated with goat milk. So this was really important for our team to find out, because we didn't know that this was a very widely held community practice, and actually our people with psychosocial disability could make far more income if they had prime goat milk production in monsoon. So just to wrap up, I think it's really important to ensure that any tool like recovery and any concept like recovery is really grounded in the local context and is really informed by local people and their priorities and their understanding of where they live. And just really excited about the Reframe publication and to be part of it. So thanks.
That goes back to how you define recovery. Is it doing a job?
Yes.
Is it being in a marriage?
Yes.
Right. So I think that differs across.
Yeah.
And I'll say that even if you leave severe mental illness, or schizophrenia,
mm-hmm.
or some of the other disorders out, even with, for someone like me with anxiety, I know it's never going to go away. I will continue to take my medication, but of course, my job, my routine, how I've set up my life, enables what I do. It's a separate thing that my anxiety actually causes me to want to work harder. So I can't stop working.
Mm-hmm.
I work 7 days a week.
Yes.
So these are things that I need to keep a control on with my therapist. When is it too much? So it really depends. Now, for me, if someone looks at me, they'll say, I have no problem.
Absolutely.
This is great. Am I recovered? No, I'm never going to be recovered. But, you know, there are certain things I must do in my life.
So talking about developing the supporting community, like you mentioned that you are taking medication to work like how others are doing. There are several others who are trying to do that. But it is also the culture outside who is a little skeptic about the inclusion of ill people. So how and what should be done about bridging this?
So that's why we say that mental health is psychosocial. We have to change environments around us. So, you know, whether, say, for example, the Seher program that works in urban basties in Pune. So if there's someone who has a mental health need, they reach out, they sensitize the person's neighbors, they get the neighbors to provide support. So that's one way to do it. Obviously, we have to have our workspaces, our schools stand up. And say very strongly that we do not discriminate and we need different and more flexible systems.
Yes. So when it comes to talking with medical health professionals, so it's either a taboo or even when they meet these professionals. So how is their approach with the patients?
I can't speak on behalf of mental health professionals, but in Reframe 2, for example, we have a piece written by a researcher who did interview multiple persons on experiences with their therapists or with their mental health professionals. Now, quite a few people said that the person was cold, maybe unforgiving. So I think just like in physical health, there are all sorts of practitioners and professionals. But because of the nature of mental health, it's very important that whichever professional speaks to clients builds an atmosphere of trust and confidentiality.
Yes. Yeah.
And if that, I don't think it happens, unfortunately, in each and every session that takes place in this country.
Basic Needs India has been in the field of community mental health for 2 decades. And our focus has been supporting and reintegrating persons suffering from severe mental illness along with their families and the community support. We have reached out more than 24,000 persons with mental illness in a few states of India. Having been in the field, we are quite sensitive to the psychosocial well-being of people affected by traumatic events, either they are kind of disaster or events, personal events to them. We have worked with the bomb blast survivors and women rescued from trafficking. So when the Fani cyclone hit the shores of Orissa, we sat with the partners with whom we are working in Orissa on what kind of intervention that we could provide. Government and also international organizations rushed to provide basic needs, that is the shelter, and care and protection. They did it. Wonderfully they did it. And what was missing, there were efforts from NIMHANS to address it, but we felt that because the partners are working in the field, it'll be really good that we take up the psychosocial interventions or well-being of the affected communities. And when we sought help, Marivala Health Initiative was happy to give the support. And that's the time we came across the reframe concepts. And we realized that what we are doing is definitely filling the large gap in psychosocial care. We were so happy because not many people support any work in mental health, least on psychosocial well-being.
Mental health practitioners do not have a code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no body per se which regulates mental health professionals. So these are all interesting things that can be explored.
Mm-hmm.
So Aparna Joshi, who has written that article.
Yes.
And also a counselor at ICALL, the tech helpline which we were referring before. So she's the one who has written the article, and we would be sharing her clip on these thoughts.
The article talks about some of the commonly encountered ethical dilemmas within the field of counseling and psychotherapy profession in India. These dilemmas are related to issues of confidentiality, informed consent, boundaries, value conflicts. They are also related to issues of psychological testing, but most importantly, they are related to issues of counselor competence, particularly given the lack of uniformity, standardization, and licensing procedures in India. It talks about some of these ethical dilemmas and how they get unfolded within the Indian context and the sociocultural sort of a context that many of us live in. It also talks about possible rights violations that happen at the ground level vis-a-vis all of these dilemmas. The article talks most importantly about the need to raise ethical awareness amongst counseling professionals. But apart from raising this awareness amongst professional, it also highlights another point, which is raising awareness among consumers of these services about their own rights. Because if you look at the mental health field, client voices or consumer or user survivor voices are conspicuous actually largely by their absence. So the article overall is an attempt to throw light on this very important issue, which is not much discussed. The article actually urges professionals to engage in constant self-reflection, to seek training in this area. It also urges to the overall field for updation of ethical guidelines and also implementation of those ethical guidelines. But at another level, the article also talks about some directions that can involve development of mechanisms for addressing client violations and increased awareness and discourse around client rights and client-led initiatives within the field of mental health.
Talking about the LGBTIQA, so this community has suffered a lot when it comes to the behavior of other people towards them.
Yes.
So because of which they have suffered a lot of stress, a lot of effect on their mental health. So what is being done right now for them?
So one thing I'll say is that the LGBTQI community has not just suffered due to discrimination in the larger society.
They have been excluded for a long time now.
Excluded for a long time, but also in terms of the psychiatry and mental health itself, the diagnosis manual, the DSM, which is like a book for diagnosing mental illness, that book said that being gay or lesbian or homosexual was a disorder. Now, that was taken out of the mental illness book only in the early 80s. That's simply because even though there was nothing scientific about it, it was still connected to society at large.
Yes.
Similarly with trans persons, that's actually still in the manual as gender dysphoria. So as we know, in this country itself, we've had history of the Hijra community. It's a traditional Indian community. So, you know, putting it in a diagnostic manual at that time was more related to social code. So even if an LGBTQIA person goes to a mental health professional, what a mental health professional may have been taught is absolutely incorrect. And so there are discriminations at two levels. One at the larger societal level, and the second at the mental health practitioner or mental health institution level itself.
So just out of curiosity, it comes to me that why is it that there's such a big gap of mental health professionals in the country when there are so many MBBS, MDs and other professionals?
So one of the easier answers is that mental health is invisible as compared to physical health. The second one is that there are not that many seats that are offered at a college level. The third answer is that how do we get more seats when more beds are filled? Now, how do you fill beds for mental health? It's slightly different. Also, why would you just put people there for the sake of being there? So it's a vicious cycle, I think. And so there aren't enough professionals. But my other counter to that is that we don't need mental health experts for each and every mental health issue.
So this is where the community help comes in.
Yes. I mean, it's very critical to have community care and not the cure.
Yes.
Because I think without the care, the cure anyway is not going to be possible.
Right.
Absolutely.
But when it comes to care, it's not just the people who are suffering from mental illnesses. It's also people who are suffering from disabilities. So people who have suffered from mental illnesses and also from other physical disabilities. So there's a lot of discrimination in that process. So would you like to see something on that?
So for persons who live with physical or sensory disabilities, there are some things pointed out in Nidhi's article where she says that there may not be ramps, there may not be a lift for a person to get into an office. Now, how many mental health practitioners can speak sign language? Okay, unless there is someone who can use sign language to communicate with a client, that leaves a whole bunch of people out. Second, persons with disabilities may be in control of their families. If they say no for therapy, how do they access therapy? So there are many, again, need gaps here that we are not covering at all.
Even when it comes to people who have mental illnesses, like I remember the conversation with Reshma and also I think Tarini.
Tarini Sham.
Yes. So they had mentioned that it is important, like when Reshma goes to a public function or a speech, she makes sure that the situations are on her favor. There is accessibility towards a quicker exit to the outdoors. There are several other facilities which she wants.
Yes.
So I think this should be by default in a lot of places. So
absolutely.
Can we
agree.
Do something by which the public arenas or corporates do something to incorporate all these facilities which they need?
Also, just adding to what he's saying, the question to it, what he's asking, Tarini was specifically saying she has BPD.
Okay.
So she could not talk about it in her office and she could not tell anybody, you know.
Yes.
Because she said, because the corporates are such a competitive environment, the moment you say you have some kind of a mental illness, you're going to be just out and sagged out, you know.
Yes.
I mean, this is so uncompassionate towards, you know, your fellow people. I mean, how do we get the corporates to make specific laws? In fact, you know, if you actually hear the podcast, I mean, I've got Shubha, who has bipolar, and she's finally come out of it. She works for Ogilvy. She's a copywriter.
Okay.
And she said that we used to sit in the office and corner and just whisper to each other that we both have bipolar, you know, and we cannot tell this to anybody else.
I've heard that podcast,
yes,
actually.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that's a big, big loophole when it comes to mental health.
It is. So, you know, abroad, they do have accessibility laws that mandate that offices do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
Of course, well, we can advocate for a law here. And there is a law here that is called the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Mm-hmm. Again, how much of it gets implemented is where the crux lies.
Absolutely.
So how do we do it? So I do expect corporates to take on their responsibility. Why do you need a law to do it?
Yeah.
Please do it responsibly. There's a lot of focus right now on diversity and inclusion. And I do believe that accessibility has to be made a big part of diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Absolutely. Now in diversity and inclusion, they're talking about women. They may be talking about LGBTQI. Mm. What about the rest?
Yeah, absolutely. How do we push them? But, you know, just telling, nobody's going to listen to us.
So I have, of course, a couple of ways of pushing. One is to raise the issue and make it more visible. The second way to do it, which I'm maybe more a fan of, is figure out a couple of corporates, give them the technical expertise, make them a model for everyone to follow. Then you have no excuse. Look at this model. It's brilliant. Of course, we want to follow it.
Yes.
When it comes to youth, which is the future, and they have suffered a lot due to parental pressure, peer pressure, educational pressure, career pressure, finding their goals pressure. So there's a lot of pressure which they go through, and it is important for them also to stay mentally fit.
So, in fact, you're right. The biggest killer of our youth today is suicide.
Hmm.
Youth mental health is critical.
Hmm.
So how are we reaching out to youth? A lot of people say that social media is terrible. But as Patty Gonzalez says in her article in Reframe 2, they actually used social media to get youth to talk about mental health.
Mm.
And so instead of demonizing certain things, let's figure out where youth like to interact, how they like to interact.
Absolutely.
And use those platforms to reach out.
Yeah.
Because it's a crying shame that suicide is the biggest killer of young people today. Mm. Not just in India, but worldwide.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just taking some more bits in terms of the reframe, where do you say, what are the topics you're going to cover? What is the vision towards it?
So, you know, the first issue of Reframe was on funding mental health.
Yes.
Because we wanted more people to put in money into mental health.
Mm.
Today, MHI is the only funder that solely focuses on mental health in the country.
Yes.
There are not many Indian funders at all funding mental health, and we want to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first issue.
Mm-hmm.
The second issue, as you pointed out, was on bridging the care gap.
Yes.
So in the next issues as well, we hope to take a theme and highlight all the different aspects around it.
Mm-hmm.
Like was pointed out in this show, there are many issues regarding mental health. It could be the cost, it could be implementation, it could be how do we safeguard anyone who has mental illness.
Yes.
So there are many themes that one can choose from.
Mm-hmm.
For this last issue of Reframe, what I did was I approached a few people, like Dr. Soumitra Pathare, like Amelina, like the article on recovery, like Nidhi.
Yes.
And I asked them to write a piece based on either their lived experience or their expertise.
Yeah.
And so a lot of pieces are of that nature.
Mm.
Yet some of the pieces are pieces that were submitted to us.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I would like to see a mix of those. I do want to keep a certain amount of curation power with myself so I can make sure that everything is covered.
Absolutely.
But ideally, I would want to see more and new voices contributing to mental health.
Right.
Absolutely. And in terms of the funding challenges, you know, MHI is the only solo fund right now in the country. How do you intend to convince others, you know, to come and, you know, support the cause?
So I tend to make myself talk at different conferences.
Oh my God. Yes.
To say that, hey, why don't you fund mental health?
Yes.
Because when you fund mental health, you're actually not just maybe supporting one person in a family or supporting the whole family. You may be enabling that person to go to school, to get a job, to roam about in their neighborhood, to have friends. So there are many other effects once you fund mental health.
Absolutely.
So the whole idea for me is to keep on talking about funding mental health and why people should look at funding mental health. Right now, if I talk to someone about funding health or funding education, the moment I say funding health, they can have a picture in their head of, say, like a BP camp. If I say funding education, the picture in your head is likely to be a girl near a blackboard or sitting at a school desk. If I say mental health, there's a blank. So I want to change that.
Absolutely. 150 million people suffering from various forms of mental illness in our country. Very few have an access to it. 82% don't even go and talk about it. What's the way forward, Rajvi, from here? What do you think? Where are we heading? Are we just in theory? Are we going into the practical implications of it? Are we changing anything?
The hope is that we are changing things. I know that there are many innovative things going on in mental health today. And like you have this podcast and we are talking about it. I hope for much more conversation in many different ways on mental health.
Absolutely.
And many different languages.
And in many different languages, not just in English. That's very important.
Great. All right. Thank you so much, Rajvi.
Thank you.
For joining us and giving us your insight on Reframe and other aspects of mental illnesses. Thank you, Ron Tucker.
Thank you.
Thank you for making me part of the show.
Sharing her personal self with us and also talking about Reframe. Also, thank you to all the authors who have contributed to Reframe and whom we have plugged in the podcast. Meera Malhotra, Jasmine Kala, Karen Mathias, Aparna Joshi and Dr. Rajaram. And thank you to my co-host, Rohan Tucker. I'm your host, Sujata, signing off. And guys, stay tuned for another very special episode. Something very, very value-adding that you guys should listen to.